The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is John Ivey from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the July 2018 copy of Sports Illustrated for Kids. Today's programming is underwritten with support from the Raleigh Kiwanis Foundation. They can be reached at www.kiwanisfoundation.org. We're going to continue with the article, Camp Want to Win. And we're going to start off learning about make a duct tape wallet. So first thing you do, create the body of the wallet. Tear off four strips of duct tape that are 9 inches long. Lay down the first strip on your kitchen counter or plastic cutting board, sticky side down. Working from the bottom up, layer each strip on top of the previous piece with a half inch of overlap. Next, pull the duct tape sheet off the counter and flip it over. Tear off four new 9-inch strips of duct tape in an alternate color. Stick your new strips to the sheet you just made, but start about a half inch down the top. Fold the edges over on the top and bottom of your sheet. Then trim the edges with scissors. Your finished sheet should be about 8.5 inches wide by 6 inches tall. Make the pockets. Tear off 2 5-inch strips. Place one sticky side down, then layer the second one with a half inch of overlap. Flip over and stick on 2 more 5-inch strips, starting a half inch down as in previous step. Trim edges so that this pocket measures 4 inches wide by 3 inches tall. For the 2 smaller pockets, tear off 2 9-inch strips of duct tape and stick them back to back. Cut this piece into 2 pieces, make them each 4 inches long by trimming the edges. Tear a 5-inch strip of duct tape, then tear in half lengthwise. For each half over your pocket pieces and trim off the extra. Number 3. Assemble the pockets. Lay all 3 pockets on top of each other, with the largest on the bottom and the top pocket 1/2 inch below the middle layer. Use a strip of tape torn in half lengthwise to attach them. Trim off the extra tape. Number 4. Put it all together. Lay out your main fabric with the side up that you want to be on the outside of the wallet and align the pockets on the upper right of the sheet. Attach with a 9-inch strip of tape torn in half lengthwise. Fold the wallet in half and secure the ends with strips of tape that have been torn in half lengthwise. Trim off the extra. Add a final strip of tape across the bottom of the wallet to secure the pockets. Number 5. Add your team's logo. Print out or draw your team's logo to fit on the front of the wallet. Using clear packing tape attached to the front of the wallet. You're finished. Now, do your chores, so you can fill your sporty wallet with some cash. Like father, like son. Guerrero, Biggio, Bichette, the major league could soon be overrun by a generation of young stars with very familiar names. Here on page 40, on the side of page 40, Craig Biggio, Houston Astros, 1988 to 2007, second base, Hall of Fame, 2015. Vladimir Guerrero, 4 teams, 1996 to 2011, outfield, Hall of Fame, 2018. And Dante Bichette, 5 teams, 1988 to 2001, outfielder, 4-time All-Star. The future of baseball looks a lot like the past. That was never more evident than back in late March when the Toronto Blue Jays played a 2-game exhibition series against the St. Louis Cardinals in Montreal. In the second game, Vlad Guerrero Jr., a 19-year-old minor leaguer who joined the Blue Jays for the series, launched a walk-off homer in the bottom of the ninth for a 1 nothing victory. For the 25,816 in attendance, it was a living flashback. Guerrero's father, a Hall of Fame outfielder, began his career with the Montreal Expos, who in 2005 became the Washington Nationals. Now, he was another number 27, circling the bases after a titanic blast, sending the fans home happy just like days long past. Vlad Jr. isn't the only familiar name leading Major League Baseball's next wave. Padres shortstop Fernando Tatis Jr., son of ex-big leaguer Fernando. Padres starter Cal Quantrill, son of longtime reliever Paul. And Twins shortstop Nick Gordon, youngest son of pitcher Tom, are all on Baseball America's 2018 Top 100. And then there are the players who joined Guerrero on the opening day roster of the New Hampshire Fisher Cats, Toronto's AA affiliate. Bo Bichette, number 8 on batting A's list and the son of slugger Dante. And Kevon Biggio, who has a Hall of Fame father of his own in Craig. It's a luxury having those guys, Fisher Cats manager John Schneider says. I literally got to write Bichette, Biggio, Guerrero in my lineup. Being a second-generation prospect can be an advantage. Spending time around big leaguers since childhood helps young players survive the season's ups and downs. They handle themselves like they're 25, 30 years old, Schneider says. When you talk to Guerrero, it's like talking to a guy who's been doing it his whole life. The ease with which Guerrero slugs home runs makes it seem as if he's been doing that his whole life as well. In May, he hit 2 homers in a game against the Portland Sea Dogs. The second one cleared the wall in left field and a small patio beyond it before caroming off the 5th-floor windows of a hotel next to New Hampshire Stadium, at least 430 feet away and 50 feet off the ground. When Vlad Jr. takes his hacks in a batting cage, it's easy to see the connection. Like his father, Vlad the younger boasts a whip-like swing with lethal bat speed. He had the same ability to routinely lace ball to all fields with an exit velocity of 100 miles per hour or more. He may be making a name for himself, but still, whatever Vlad Jr. goes, and wherever he goes, the shadow of his father follows. On a recent road trip in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, the team bus drove by an ad on an electronic billboard that blared Vlad Jr. is coming to Harrisburg with a picture of him and his dad side by side. The only other player in the Eastern League to get that kind of attention is Tim Tebow of the Binghamton Rumble Ponies. But the attention doesn't seem to affect Guerrero much. He's done a really good job of making his own way and being his own dude, Schneider says. Obviously, it's not easy to deal with, but he's doing great with it. Vlad Jr. doesn't seem pressured by the association with his Hall of Fame dad at all. Asked during spring training what he thinks of his father's accomplishments, he replied, "It inspires me to keep working, to keep getting better, and to put up the same numbers he did." Exactly the same? I don't want to put up better numbers than him or less. I want to put up exactly what he did. That's a lofty goal for any player, no matter his bloodlines. But this is the future Vlad Jr. has envisioned since he was 6, when he first decided he wanted to play professionally. From then, he was tutored in the Dominican Republic by his uncle, former big leaguer Wilton Guerrero. By age 13, he was digging in against 18- and 19-year-old pitchers and clobbering them. "I wasn't scared because they threw the ball and I hit it," he says. Both Guerrero and Bichette insist that their last names add no pressure. "It's the same as anyone else who considered a high prospect," says Bichette. "People have expectations, but for me, I'm just worried about playing hard and getting better." "You're trying to climb the ladder. You've got enough to worry about," says Yankees manager Aaron Boone, a third-generation player. "The pitcher doesn't care who you are. He's just trying to get you out." The pressure of outdoing dad is more than balanced by the benefits of growing up around the game. When Bichette was 14, his father became the Colorado Rockies hitting coach. That year, Bo spent his summer with Troy Tulowitzki, Nolan Arenado, Michael Cudjier, and the rest of the Colorado's all-star hitters. I got to learn a lot from them and pick and choose what I liked, he says. Guerrero's and Bichette's common background is not something they dwell on. Says Guerrero, when we talk about our careers, not our fathers. Rising Suns, Nick Gordon, Minnesota Twins shortstop. Tom Gordon, 8 seasons, 1988-2009, right-handed pitcher, all saves, American League saves leader, 46 in 1998 with the Red Sox. Just like his older half-brother, D, who began as a shortstop with the Los Angeles Dodgers and is now a center fielder with the Seattle Mariners, Nick is an infielder by trade. The number 5 pick in the 2014 draft out of Olympia High in Orlando, the 22-year-old is climbing his way through the Twins system, hitting 270, 341, 408 at a double-A Chattanooga last season, enough to earn an invite to the future games. The majors are within reach. Nick was promoted to AAA in May after hitting 333 for Chattanooga. But if Nick can't make it as a shortstop, he can always follow his dad as a pitcher. As a junior in high school, Nick had a 0.7 ERA with 44 strikeouts in 35 and 2 1/3 innings. One of the best prospects in baseball was obtained 2 years ago in a trade with the White Sox for journeyman pitcher James Shields. The deal might be the best of A.J. Perella's 4-year stint as general manager of the Padres. The infielder, 19, shares not only a name with his father, but also the potential to excite fans. Fernando Tatis Sr. did that when he hit 2 grand slams in 1 inning for the St. Louis Cardinals in a game against the Dodgers in 1999. Tatis Jr. jumped to AA last season after hitting 281, 390, and 520 in A-ball, and he hit 22 home runs, including 1 grand slam. He homered 9 times in his first 45 games this season. Fernando Tatis Jr., San Diego Padres infielder. Fernando Tatis, 5 teams, 1997 to 2010, third baseman, hit 265 and with 50 steals. Cal Quantrill, San Diego Padres pitcher. Paul Quantrill, 7 teams, 1992 to 2005, right-handed pitcher, holds Yankees record for appearances, 86 set in 2004. If there is one thing Cal hopes to inherit from his father, it is durability. Paul Quantrill was a mainstay in bullpens across the majors for nearly 15 years, appearing in 80 or more games in 4 straight seasons, from 2001 to 2004. Cal, the 8th pick of the 2016 draft out of Stanford, will try to match that reliability as a starter. He started a total of 22 games last season in stints at High A Lake Elsinore and Double A San Antonio. Next article we have, page 44 to 46, Shake, Roll, and Play Ball. With a game dead ball, you can simulate America's pastime during any season, no matter where you are. It's the bottom of the ninth, and the bases are loaded. The home team is down by 2, and there are 2 outs. The count is full. The pitcher throws. A die is rolled. It's a 6. If you want to know what happened in the above scenario, you're going to need to check out Dead Ball, a baseball game played entirely with dice and a pencil. Designed in January 2017 by W.M. Akers, Deadball is a low-tech, single-player experience that features real or fictional players. Akers conceived of the game after the birth of his son, Dash. He wanted something to help pass the time during the dead of baseball's off-season. I started thinking, there's got to be a way for me to design a baseball game that I can play while I'm hanging out with my kid that's basically simple enough that I can do at an at-bat while he's taking a bite of food, Aker says. In the original version of the game, he used a pair of 10-sided dice to generate a number between 0 and 99. He would compare that number to the first 2 digits of a player's batting average. if the rolled number was equal to or lower than the rounded up batting average, the batter got a hit. If the rolled number was higher than his average, the batter was out. The result was then marked on the scorecard. Akers then added a way to factor in the skill of the pitcher using ERA. As he continued to test the game, he realized it had potential when he found himself getting so invested that it would become mad at the results. The Mets fan got particularly upset when the mighty 1927 New York Yankees kept beating a team of Negro League All-Stars. I figured if this silly little game I made up with just a handful of dice and a piece of paper could make me angry and make me angry in the same way baseball makes me angry, that I was probably onto something, Akers says. Pretty soon, dead ball moved from the baby's high chair to Dad's desk, where Akers began to develop more advanced rules. When his wife discovered him rolling dice one day in his home office, she said it was time to try to make money off his work. So that March, Akers, who is a writer when he's not working on Deadball, put the game on Kickstarter, a website on which people pledge money to support a project in return for early success. Akers set a goal of $500 in 25 days. He ended up raising $7,748. The thing about baseball people is that they are addicted to baseball, Akers says, explaining the game's popularity. They love it so much that even something as simple as rolling dice and scratching out lines on a piece of paper, it triggers the thing inside your brain that feels like you're at the ballpark. The finished product was a 61-page book, part rules reference and part fictional encyclopedia. Gamers are invited to play with made-up athletes like second baseman Ian White, who is described in the book as perhaps the best power infielder in the league and a passable ballroom dancer. Or they can take over one of the teams in the Southern Circuit, such as the defending champion Charlottesville Flycatchers. People who pledge enough money on Kickstarter had players named after them or their children, since a baby was the game's inspiration. Advanced deadball players can take advantage of in-game tactics like shifting the infield and pickoff attempts. There are also off-the-field effects, such as injuries and generating prospects, and they are all controlled by a roll of the dice. On the next page, you can play a simplified version of the game to get a feel for how it works. Then, if you're ready, you can graduate to the full version of the game. Akers recently came out with an expansion, Deadball, Year 2. He even has plans for a Deadball Hall of Fame. No word yet on what prospective inductees will have to roll to be enshrined. Your turn. We picked our team. Choose your players and turn the pages to challenge us. Catcher, Johnny Bench. Batting average, .267. First base, Lou Gehrig. Batting average, .340. Shortstop, Manny Machado. Batting average, .282. The rules. First, you'll need a way to generate random numbers. The easiest way is to use a standard set of 7 role-playing dice. They're usually sold together. Or you can use one of many dice rolling websites or apps. Next, fill out the lineups on the scorecard on the opposite page. Next to each name, write the player's position and his batter target. The first 2 digits of his batting average. Find the pitcher's ERA on the pitch die table and write down what it says. That's the pitch die. For instance, if your pitcher's ERA is 2.50, you'll use the number that comes up when you roll the 8-sided die. We provided the sample team you can play with or against. Now we're ready to play ball. The batter rolls a 100. That's 2 10-sided dice, using one die result as the 10's place and the other as the 1's place. The pitcher rolls the pitch die and adds the result to what the batter rolled. If there is a minus sign before his pitch die number, you subtract the result of the roll. We call that the modified swing score. If the MSS is equal to or less than the batter target, it's a hit. If the MSS is 1 to 5 points higher, it's a walk. If it's more than 5 points higher, the batter is out. If the result is an out, find the final digit on the MSS on the out table. That will tell you how the batter was retired. If the result is a hit, roll the 20-sided die and find the result on the basic hit table. If it says roll for DEF, that means the defense has a chance to take away the hit or make an error. Roll a D12 and consult the defense table to see if the result is adjusted. Once the final result has been determined, record it on the scorecard. If the batter makes an out, write the notation in parentheses from the out table. If he gets on base, draw the first leg of a diamond to show his trip to first base. Draw the second leg when he goes to second and the third when he goes to third. When he scores, complete the diamond and fill it in. Here's a sample plate appearance. Mike Trout is batting against Clayton Kershaw. Trout has a 305 batting average, so his batting target is 30. Kershaw's ERA is 2.37, which makes his pitch die D8, the 8-sided die. First, roll a D100. Let's say it comes up 21. Then roll the pitch die. Let's say that is 7. Adding the two rolls together gives us 28. Since that's less than the batter target, Trout gets a hit. To find out what kind, we roll the D20. Imagine it comes up 13. That means Trout hits a double. But since the basic hit table tells us to roll for DEF, we have to roll one more die, the D12. See, it comes up 11. So the defense made a nice play and actually held Trout to a single. But any base runners will still take an extra base. We record that result to Trout's name on the scorecard, and Babe Ruth comes to the plate, and we start all over. Now, get out there and play ball. Third base, Jose Ramirez, batting average 291. Left field, Hank Aaron, batting average 305. Center field, Mike Trout, batting average 305. Right field, Babe Ruth, batting average 342. And pitcher, Buzz Beamer, batting average 311, ERA 2.86. From the pages of Sports Illustrated, a picture here of Arizona's affable 7-foot-1 center, Andre Dayton. First things first, what you know one thing, he's going to be the player in his draft class, the first player in his draft class. But except golf. Number one, DeAndre Ayton. If a team of basketball scientists were asked to build the perfect big man in a laboratory, the finished product would look a lot like DeAndre Ayton. The problem on a Wednesday night in the middle of May is that the 7-foot-1, 250-pound Ayton is nowhere near a basketball hoop. Golf is a strange game, he says. Ayton has already sprayed ground balls over a Top Golf in Scottsdale, Arizona, but he refuses to give up. He just watched his 41-year-old trainer, Rashid Hazard, swing calmly, almost in slow motion, and loft several beautiful iron shots. But you got the old man swing, Ayton tells him. No swag. Standing in the corner stall on the lower level, Ayton licks his index finger and whirls it around his head. Always check the wind, the 19-year-old says. Then he begins his backswing. Contorting his 7-foot-5 wingspan around a driver that's at least 6 inches too short. And another shank. Ayton cackles with delight. This is the part of the Andre Ayton experience. His teammate at Arizona, Raleigh Alkin, says, when the situation is down or quiet, he'll loosen everyone up. Laugh, crack jokes. There's never a bad time with him. Wildcats assistant Lorenzo Romar predicts that one day Ayton will be on Inside the NBA. His mom, Andrea, calls him both a comedian and an entertainer. After another round of scuffs and slices, Ayton finally turns to the group of friends behind him, looks around at the corner stall, and shakes his head. It's a weird angle, he decides. There are a few different versions of Ayton, and which one you get depends on what you're talking about. If the topic is basketball, he says all the right things. If the topic is life off the court, he will crack jokes about himself and everyone around him. He becomes the guy who orders two desserts, a massive brownie sundae and a Snickers pie, at lunch and then refuses to share with his girlfriend, Anissa, for two reasons. First, because he's flirting with her, and also because it's making the whole table laugh. Then when Anissa successfully steals one of the desserts, he sprawls across the table trying to take it back. As long as everyone else is having a good time, so is he. But if he's talking about the journey that brought him to where he is now, a more guarded side emerges. Aiden was raised in the Bahamas until he was 12. He remains intensely proud of his homeland, and people there are proud of him, too. Michael Thompson, the Bahamian big man who was drafted number one in 1978 and whose son Clay played for the Warriors, says, "I watched every Arizona game I could this year. It's thrilling, man. I feel like I've got another son in the NBA." It was everything that came after the Bahamas that complicated Aiden's story. Home, he says, "I was perfect. I was home. I don't even want to talk about AAU. When I stepped foot in the United States, my life became a job." After landing on the radar of scouts at the 2011 Jeff Rogers camp in Nassau, Aiden was offered the chance to come to the United States by a couple of coaches. His mother, his stepfather Alvin, decided that it was the right thing to do. Basketball aside, it was a chance at a free education. So he moved to San Diego as a 6'5", 12-year-old. Less than 2 years later, he was 6'10", and christened the best eighth-grade player in the country. "It felt normal," Aiden says, "until I grew up and realized I never really had a childhood. It was just basketball and business. Never went to Disneyland or any of that. Kids used to tell me about it, and I'd have to lie and say, 'Yeah, I went,' but I never knew any of that." For the next few years, Aiden lived with three different host families and spent most weekends traveling the grassroots hoops circuit. "Sometimes I go to a month without talking to my mother," he says. "You're in the gym, going 8 a.m. to 7 p.m. It was like a job." Fran Fischillin, ESPN commentator and draft expert, thinks that the awkward fit at Arizona may eventually work in Aiden's favor. "He was forced to defend wing players and guards," he says. "I think it did him wonders. He can move his feet extremely well on the perimeter. He's not going to be a guy you have to cover up in late clock emergencies, switch situations. He's going to be able to hold his own against the electric guards and do a reasonably good job keeping them out of the lane." Aiden brushes aside the small question. "Small ball? What is small ball? I play basketball. I play center. And if you haven't watched me play, I'm not a regular big man. I can move my feet. Not saying I can stop anyone out there who's in front of me, but trust me, I can really be a problem on the perimeter guarding somebody. I can switch from the center to the guards. The game is evolving. You got dudes like Joel Embiid, Anthony Davis, all these seven-footers doing everything. They're unstoppable. We can grab the board, make it down the floor, and then score just as well. There's no stopping us." Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Sports Illustrated for Kids. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm John Ivey, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with support from the Raleigh Kiwanis Foundation. They can be reached at www.kiwanisfoundation.org. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comment or questions, please call 919-832-5138.